Welcome to Healthcare Crossroads, a podcast showcasing the connections we make in healthcare data, compliance, and patient care. We are at a crossroads in healthcare. Let's make an impact by bringing together physicians, nurses, healthcare information management professionals, and legal experts in healthcare. Everyone in healthcare intersects. Let's find out how. This is Healthcare Crossroads. Here is your host, Jennifer McNamara.
Hello and welcome to the Healthcare Crossroads podcast. My name is Jennifer McNamara and I am your host. I want to, on behalf of OncoSpark, our sponsors, welcome you to the show. As always, we are here to talk about the connections we make in compliance, data, and patient care. First of all, though, how is everyone doing out there? I don't know if you've gotten out there and done anything fun this spring so far. I just want to remind everyone, you know, we work a lot. We work really hard, right, in healthcare. But I hope you all can get out there and do something fun, something off the grid. Get out there and enjoy this beautiful weather. So I did something kind of out of the norm for myself this past weekend. And some friends of ours, we got on this train ride from Springdale, Arkansas, all the way down to Van Buren, Arkansas. It's about a three-hour train ride through the Boston Mountains on the Arkansas-Missouri Railroad. It was like an old-timey train. It was so cool. And just getting there to relax and just de-stress, not even think about work. And, you know, some of the chaos we deal with all week, sometimes it stays with us and it's nice to get away and just, you know, detox from all that chaos and really focus on ourselves and our families and what life is all about, right? So I hope you can do that sometime, you know, this weekend that we're approaching. We're halfway through the week, right? So I hope you enjoy the rest of your week and you have a nice weekend ahead. But first, let's talk about what we are going to expect in today's episode ahead. Today, we're here to talk about something that I think I've not really talked about on this show before. We do have our efforts really geared toward reaching everyone that deals with patient care and data in the healthcare arena. So today, I have a very special guest, actually, on the show. We're going to talk about some of the insights that we can, how we can navigate the PBM market. There are companies out there such as Health Trust. One of the representatives of Health Trust, Joey Dizenhaus, is on the show today. Very, very excited to meet with Joey. Joey Dizenhaus is the head of pharmacy services at Health Trust. So we're going to sit down with Joey today, and we are going to discuss some of the trends that we're seeing in healthcare data when it comes to the pharmacy arena. We're going to talk about prior authorization reforms, what we can expect or what we would like to see. In the prior authorization arena. We're going to talk about some of the chaos that we have seen over the years, what the pandemic has taught us, and of course, we're going to look at some unique areas that we want to be aware of as patients and healthcare providers. So stay tuned for my conversation with Joey Dizenhaus right after the break.
The team at OncoSpark offers a unique opportunity to grow your career in the business of medicine through their virtual specialty conference series. The reality of attending conferences in person is constantly changing. We give you the opportunity to learn virtually from industry leaders in top specialties such as pain management, general surgery, ophthalmology, and orthopedics. We present timely industry topics to help you navigate regulatory guidelines and best practices in coding, billing, and practice management from the experts in the field. Whether you are interested in becoming the go-to expert in your field, providing additional knowledge for your education program, or you're ready to dive into other specialties, we have you covered. Visit sparkadvise.com to learn more. We hope to see you at our 2023 events.
Well, as mentioned, I have my very special guest on the show today. I have Joey Dizenhaus. Did I say that correctly, Joey?
Yep.
Great. Well, it's so nice to have you on the show. Before I get started and we ask you some questions to get to know you a little bit better, I first wanted to let our listeners know that we are really here to, as I mentioned, bridge the gap between, you know, compliance, data, patient care. We're really going to focus today on how we can help patients. There's so much data out there, and I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation I'm going to have with Joey. So Joey, first of all, tell us a little about your history. How long have you been in healthcare and a little bit about how you got here?
Sure. Yeah. So I've been in healthcare my entire career, which is 25 years plus or minus. And I'm an actuary by background. So I grew up in the sort of the quantitative elements of insurance in general, and have been focused on primarily medical and pharmacy insurance during my tenure, and started my career in Canada, where of course the health system is very different than we have here, and have spent some time in the UK as well, and so it's sort of an interesting contrast to look at the three sort of crown systems and how they're similar in some ways, but more commonly different in how they're executed. So I've been in the U.S. primarily the southeastern U.S. for 20 years basically, and so have spent most of my time practicing here.
Well, that's wonderful. You know, I'm sure you have a wealth of knowledge, especially with the Canadian and the U.K. You know, it's interesting. My dad was born in Canada, and I've had conversations with him about just different things and people I've met there. I've been visited there quite a few times and had conversations specifically about healthcare and how different it really is. So I can definitely relate to maybe some of the things you encountered. But as it sits right now, right, with the U.S. healthcare, it's chaos. We know it's just complete chaos. But what are some of the trends that you've seen in your, as you mentioned, tenure in this area? With the data, we see data tells us a lot, and it tells us what needs patients have, right? So as we drive forward with a technology, like I like to say, technology forward industry, as we're heading, what do we need to keep in mind with some of the trends we're seeing?
Sure. Well, why don't we just dive right into the deep end, right? There's a lot to unpack there, and I think that the ability to have measurable, useful data in the decisions that are made by risk-bearing entities, by providers, and by patients is really sort of the classic problem of healthcare, right? We have technology-based, historically there's been technology-based issues to that data, but as those barriers fall away, as the tech sort of advances, we still seem to have some challenges in getting a sort of a stable, credible, universal data set to be used in all situations. There's a lot of one-off capabilities focusing on portions of data, and so again, a lot to unpack there. But I think that there are certainly some good things about the technological advances we've seen, and the ability to understand from a risk management perspective, sort of a patient population beyond when you are the insurance company, right? And so historically, the insurance company would have access to a lot of information, but you know, if the plan that we're talking about is self-funded, right, then it is that plan sponsor that is at risk for all of those expenses. An insurer may be telling them what to expect in cost, but the risk falls on that plan. And so that plan having that transparency into the data, timely data, is truly important. And for medical insurance, you know, that data still has a fairly substantial lag on it, right? You're always sort of working 3 months in the past or more. That's difficult. I don't know that anyone's figured out a solution for that. And until we can get past some of the sort of super complex and, in my view, excessive revenue cycle processes we have here, it's not going to get any better. That lag is still going to be there. Of course, on the pharmacy side, we have much more closer to real-time data access, or even real-time data access, which makes things easier, provided the data is being shared. So there's always the issue from the plan sponsor's perspective of, am I getting all of my data? And does that data belong to me? I think the questions are being asked now more than ever. There's obviously a lot of legislative movement in Washington, and these topics continue to sort of bubble up to the surface, the use of data, the transparency of data, whether that is costs for services or, margins for PBMs or what have you. I think we're asking the right questions and trying to open a dialogue to a path. But I choose those words carefully because I know that it's unlikely that we'll find ourselves with an aha moment and a simple answer mm-hmm. that gives everyone the information they want tomorrow. I guess a couple of things I would leave you with on that is sometimes sometimes data can be, you know, you've heard the expression analysis paralysis, right? I'm sure. And oftentimes there is a yearning for data, so much so that it can cause a paralyzing of how to use the information, too much or information that is easily misconstrued. And so I think we need to be careful about what we ask for or how we use the data that we ask for. And then finally, as it relates to sort of, let's call it care technology, right? The furtherance of quality of life in debilitating illness, I think there's unquestionably a dramatic and remarkable continued progress there, right? The use of technology in in implants and in pharmacotherapy is tremendous. And if we didn't have to pay for it, if there wasn't a bill for it, it would be universally tremendous. But unfortunately, these things can be expensive and there has to be a sort of a financial balance to it. Otherwise, we'll, continue to spend more and more of our GDP until we have other problems to deal with.
100%. And, you talked about all the data we're gathering, and we've gathered so much and we still can't seem to organize in a way or get it so, everyone to be consistent, which I think when Medicare came up with their initiative to try to reform prior authorizations, for instance, that was the goal, to kind of try and bring everyone on the same page. And of course, we all wish it was tomorrow, right? But now it's like, we're like, oh, a few years off. Still, with those announcements, we were so excited that they're trying to reform this. But then we're like, oh, we got to wait still, and we're like, we've been waiting so long. So let's kind of talk about that one piece, because I know with obviously with the drugs, and also even with what I deal mostly with procedures and things like that, I still feel that we still have a long way to go. But when it comes to the reforms that they've done, to improve this, let's just talk about for pharmacy, for instance, and what you deal with. How could reforms in your area really benefit patients? What are you dealing with when it comes to prior authorizations?
Sure. Yeah, so in some ways, I would say that we're sort of many steps ahead of where the federal program is trying to get, right? In our business, we deal with, when it comes to pharmacy, we're dealing with primarily commercial plans, right? And so the decision making related to prior authorization is a combination of the PBM's role and then the plan's role. Or in our case, we play a role in that because we have an aggregated group of plan sponsors that we represent. And so there's a few things that I would say as themes in the industry. And I'm going to talk about the commercial space where this path has been in place for a while in pharmacy. I found that PBMs are a bit too focused on things like net promoter score, right, as a measure of satisfaction, right? They want their customers to be happy, which is a good thing, don't get me wrong. However, a prior authorization is not just designed to make sure that a patient isn't spending money on a drug they don't need. It's designed to make sure that a patient isn't putting themselves into potential unnecessary risk of side effects, right? Or unnecessary treatments, right? Additional products. Every drug has effects and every drug has side effects. And so what we found is that traditional prior authorization criteria have been a little bit too lax. And so what we've done is we've added additional rigor, not designed to make the process more cumbersome or to take longer, but designed to just collect the necessary data for the proof points. And so one example of that would be where instead of sort of traditional yes-no questions about the patient, it's the requirement of documentation, right, in the medical record that shows the patient has the necessary ailment, the necessary criteria, and or has been through other treatments without success, whatever the criteria might be, goes a long way to ensuring that the patient needs that particular treatment. I'd also say that it certainly is not just about financials. We've created custom edits, clinical edits in the prior auth process that are focused on safety. There are many contraindications out there. Patients taking drug A and drug B, and they don't like each other. They don't mix well. right? Making sure that prescribers have all that information so when they want to write the script, they know, because sometimes prior auths can be approved for a year or 2 years at a time, which is great unless there are contraindications that could have happened in the last 6 months and no one's looked at it since then. So we do things like that, and we think that that helps. I think looking for harmonization is going to be really difficult because, you know, the function of the prior authorization, the function of sourcing the drugs, and the function of formulary design, if owned by the same party without oversight, creates a lot of misalignment of incentives. And that's part of the reason why we hear all the negative PR we hear about the industry, and particularly in the PBM space. Some of it is deserved, in my view. Some of it is just a byproduct of a bad model, right? And sort of too much control in one place without oversight. And that's, you know, again, that's where we come in, is sort of the oversight part of it, to make sure that it's sort of the right drug in the right place at the right time. And a lot of what I'm saying applies to services, prior authorization of services in the medical insurance space as well. It's just not as easy to compartmentalize the way I just did with pharmacy. But one thing I would add is that my comment about rev cycle earlier, there are unnecessary steps in the process that are at a minimum designed to confuse, designed to add steps, which we can argue why they might go into place, why an insurance company might do that. But they also just add expense to the system, right? So I'll give you an example without pointing any fingers. If you have a service that requires a prior authorization, it can be that the provider has to submit that prior authorization to the payer, right, to the insurance company for that service. And then they'll get an approval, let's say, and then they'll go ahead and perform the service. And then after performing the service, they'll get a denial for payment with the argument that the patient's not eligible for the service, but the service was covered. So in other words, the provider didn't realize there's two prior authorizations they have to go through, right? And could have very easily explained that. Again, you can argue the reasons why those things are out there, but it is, if we believe that healthcare is a zero-sum game where there's a certain amount of money we need to treat the population that we have, the less money that gets sent out the side door and the back door into just procedures and protocol of administrivia, to me, is a win. And depending on who you believe, that could be 20 cents on the dollar, could be 30 cents on the dollar of the trillions that we spend in healthcare.
I 100% agree with you. I spent some time going over some of the authorizations that we submit with our clients for pharmacy benefits, and some of the questions that we have to answer are very important questions. And I feel like it's more of a need now to have qualified people doing this work, right? Because those are questions that not the average person can answer. Yeah, the information might be in the chart, but are you educated and trained to understand how important these questions are? So I think that's so important. On the procedure side, I 100% agree with you. I'll give you an example. We see this a lot in surgery all the time where, you know, we get authorization for a certain procedure, right? But we have, in plastic surgery, for instance, we have these products that one payer may not like that brand. They don't want that brand of that product, right? So in their policy, if you don't read it, of course, you miss that, where it says these brand names we will cover, but this one we will not. But hey, guess what? The provider likes this one. This is the good one, right? And they're like ordering it. Then the ASC finds out that it's not covered by their patient's plan. We've already said, oh, the prior authorization's good. And nobody checked that. And it's a big old mess later on. And then the patient doesn't have to pay, right? Because it wasn't their fault. But at the end of the day, you've lost money. You know, it's this one less piece of reimbursement that you could have used to, improve the life of somebody else. And so you think about how it just trickles down, right? And I think we have to do better and stop, for instance, duplicating services by not having the correct documentation and talking to each other, having ways to communicate effectively. It's just a mess, but you know, we can talk all day, right? Authorizations and
It really is. When I do, I can really relate to your comment in the ASC space, because you know the classic challenge now with pharma as well in that space, and you gave an example, and there's lots of them. It's only going to get a lot worse too, where the payers are starting to leverage formulary based decisions because they're getting rebates from the manufacturers and they want to use their product. I'm certainly a big proponent of allowing the provider to make the decision about what the drug should be. That's not a decision for a payer to make. But in the case where you have, biosimilars and direct substitutes that could be, interchangeable, let's just assume for the example, well, there is some value in making sure we get to the lowest cost product for the plan and for the patient. But the lowest cost product needs to be determined with all the sources of money, not the lowest cost product because it's generating a bunch of operating margin for someone else that no one is seeing, right? When a provider buys and bills a drug, we know exactly what it costs. When a drug is providing big rebates behind the scenes, right, those rebates are part of the economics, but they're retained typically by another third party, an aggregator, or even the payer directly. So this is an area where we're fighting two battles at the same time. The ability for providers to make the decision and control the product, not being forced to white bag and other things like that, which has all sorts of supply chain and safety issues. But also the economics, which are emerging where J-code type provider administered drugs today are where the big blockbuster drugs were 20 years ago, where the rebates are really starting to grow. They haven't gotten there yet, but they're really growing. And soon enough, they'll be so big that it'll be impossible to undo a payer decision. And it'll just make life a lot harder. The example you gave will just become more common. And then, people on your team have to spend more time looking through the policies and this game of cat and mouse continues. And that, to me, that's just wasted time. That's inefficiency in the system.
I 100% agree. I mean, you talk about waste in healthcare. There is just so much in the business side. I've been doing this 20 years and I've seen a lot of waste myself, trying myself to put out initiatives like in my own departments, can we try it this way? Not that I want someone to lose their job, but let's use this person somewhere else where they're more efficient, and let's use technology where we can be more efficient in this area. It's not about, moving people around, putting them in the right position, but let's save on time and be efficient. And we're not in the old days where we had to call every payer or we had to, we have ways to get information very quickly these days. So let's try to be efficient. But we're here to talk about patients. I mean, we're in healthcare because we care about patients. I mean, the most of us that went into healthcare, that was our goal. We're people, right? So I'm a patient. I'm sure you're a patient at times. We're all patients at times, right? So the cost of care is important to us as people, as humans, individuals. So I'm not going to have to tell anyone out there listening, the cost of drugs is ridiculous at times. So there are patients, of course, we work in oncology, so it's ridiculous what we see some of the costs of these drugs. It's a concern not only for patients, but also for physicians, because they know that a patient needs, like you mentioned, this drug, and they want them to try something cheaper or different, right? And you've seen a lot of the trends over the years. In your experience, you mentioned some of it, but elaborate a little bit more on what are some of the things we've seen that have led to the increase in drug costs that we are today? Inflation, of course, being one, but what are some of the others?
Yeah, and interestingly, inflation to me doesn't really hit the top of the list. It's sort of behind the scenes. It exists, you're absolutely right, but the elasticity of demand for drugs, right? Because of the dynamics of how insurance works, there's almost no variability in demand. People want the drug at any cost. They're often not seeing the cost in the first place. So inflation sort of hits us in a roundabout way, if you will. So in terms of the most concerning as it relates to the cost of drugs, volatility. If you're thinking about what is going to impact the cost of a program, right? Let's say you're a plan sponsor and you manage 100,000 lives of various, men and women and children and elderly people and so forth, and you're trying to figure out how much am I going to spend, right? there's a few different things that matter in doing that work, right? One is unit cost, which you were getting. How much does that drug cost? What does it cost to put a 10 milligram tablet of this molecule together versus last year? Number two, utilization. Are more people using that same drug than previously because it's efficacious, it helps, and or a lot of advertising money spent there to tell people about it. Number three is what I call intensity or mix. So replacing a previously cheaper drug to treat a particular condition with a new, more expensive drug to treat the same condition, right? Those three things have been in the formula. You probably used it yourself in terms of cost trend for as long as I've been in the business, right? But volatility, which is sort of like a fourth one, you can argue it's a function of mix, certainly, but that volatility is the real nuance that has caused a lot of volatility in the expenses for these programs. And so what I mean by that is, 10 years ago, it was very difficult to have a patient that needed $100,000 of pharma treatment in a year. It was extremely rare, right? And now there are seven-figure treatments, right? And some of them are incredible life-saving treatments, improving quality of life immensely, right? And I'm not judging cost to benefit in that comment, but there are also seven-figure drugs that don't save lives or markedly improve quality of life. And so the probability has increased that as a plan sponsor, you could end up with, even a large plan sponsor, you could end up with a single patient that could dramatically impact your budget for the year and impact your ability to keep contributions for your patients down. It can cause personal bankruptcy depending on how well or not well that patient is insured. All sorts of volatility in at the right end of the curve, the rare disease, super expensive, non-competitive agents out there. And then on the other side of the spectrum, right, but still driving cost trend, are classes where drugs are potentially highly utilized and modestly expensive, right? So again, I'm not commenting on efficacy in this portion of what I'm saying, but when you look at treatment for traditional T2 diabetes and all of the all of the biologic agents, injectable agents that are out there in that capacity, treating the diabetic population, that might be 6 to 10% of the population, depending on your subset, right? But now these same drugs, these same agents, many of them are being used to treat for weight loss, right? To treat obesity, and based on the definition of how those drugs are being used today, within or even if they're not being used within the plan design, it doesn't matter. You're talking about 50% or more of the population being eligible for these drugs. So if 50% of the population starts using a drug that is modestly expensive, that in and of itself will blow the budgets of just about every plan sponsor out there. So it doesn't have to be a $1 million drug to create a big risk when it captures so much of the population. So that's a relatively new example of trend risk on the other side. And so you've got almost a tale of two issues here. Really low frequency, super high expensive products that are impossible to predict. And then modestly expensive, but potentially treating lots and lots and lots of people, products that are coming up quickly on us. And between the two, there's just a lot of volatility that you can't hide from, not really, as a risk-bearing entity.
No, it's 100% true. I mean, everything you said is so insightful, and I'm really looking forward to hearing feedback from our listeners that is, really need to hear this stuff, and providers need to hear this. Everyone in healthcare needs to hear how this is playing out. And outside of the chaos from our payers, we really just want to also focus to what we can do on our own individual practices, facilities, wherever we're able to make some kind of adjustment, maybe in processes and better communication skills. I think we can probably do that. And I've been working some with some patient advocates and figured out, how we can get patients to be aware of some of the programs out there and resources that are out there for them that don't know about. And I know there is what some may be familiar with is called copay assistance programs. And I'm not sure how many listeners out there know about this, but if we could just take a couple minutes and just discuss just from your understanding and what you know, what our listeners can expect to know about this information, how it can help them. What do we want to kind of let them know about copay assistance programs?
Yeah, that's a really great point. In terms of looking at opportunities for the patient, right? The crux of it is this: drug manufacturers offer incentives or money to help in various situations for use of their product. And they offer, we've talked about money that they might offer to the payer, right, in a rebate to put the drug on the formulary. But there's another vertical of money that they will typically spend in, and that is for the patient. And it's done a few different ways, right? There's programs that are designed for providers to help in cases, in places where, drugs are need to be made available for patients that don't have the means. And then for the patients directly, whether it's a provider-administered drug or just a regular, small molecule that the patient gets at the pharmacy and takes home with them and takes. And so what the programs do, and there's a few different kinds, but generally speaking, what these programs will do is they'll say, if you, the patient, have insurance, that insurance may not be all that great. You may have coverage, but that insurance still says you need to pay 20% of the cost of the drug. Maybe the drug's, $1,500 a month. That's $300 out of your pocket a month. That's real money, right? So copay assistance, which might be offered by the manufacturer, will say, if you, the patient, qualify, then we will cover some or all, or most usually, of that $300 that you had to pay. Maybe you as the patient will only pay $20. No matter what, that's the most you'll pay. And then we, the manufacturer, will cover the rest of that difference of what you owed as the patient, right? Not going to cover amounts that your insurance plan was going to cover, but the part that you had to pay out of your pocket, we, the drug manufacturer, will pick up all but, say, $20 of it, or we'll pick up all of it, whatever they all vary. But many drugs have these types of programs in place. And in my experience, they don't have a lot of fine print. They're not, getting denied surprisingly on the back end with any real frequency. One exception is sometimes based on patient's income. So typically it's the federal poverty line or FPL that's used as the determinant, but it's usually a big multiple of it, four or five times that federal poverty line, which, just to give you a frame of reference, would be something like $150,000 a year for a family of four, which in my mind is not a poverty line type, numbers. But certainly there are people who earn above that line. And so if you do, sometimes the manufacturer will deny eligibility for the assistance based on that. But most of the time you qualify, because you're insured and you're only asking for help in the part that the insurance wasn't covering. Just to be clear, that's really just one kind of patient assistance. There's several of them, including those that are designed for patients that have no insurance. And these are all good programs that it is good that the manufacturers make them available. Although we are starting to see some evolution of those practices where I think because more and more use of those programs has proliferated, as a result, the manufacturers may be starting to scale them back in perhaps they didn't expect they'd spend as much as they did on them. I don't know. I wouldn't care to speculate, but I do think we are seeing some acts from some manufacturers of, okay, we used to offer this, now we're going to scale this back. But I also should say that where these programs are getting scaled back in some ways are due to other programs that are interfering with that patient assistance program, such as another third party coming in and trying to get the manufacturer to pay for the whole cost of the drug instead of some of the drug, and then keeping a piece for themselves as a profit, right? And so a lot of practices, confusing, multifaceted practices out there, creating a lot of noise. But my point is that the attention that it has garnered has been such that manufacturers have started to reevaluate, it would appear, some of these patient assistance programs, and maybe that will mean that they will start to dwindle over time. It's something we're keeping our eye on as well.
I agree. Yeah, we all should be, I think. And we are going to put in our show notes some helpful links for our listeners, just so you can kind of do your own homework a little bit, so that you can have access to some of that information. And finally, I wanted to talk about something. You know, we're all coming out, I think we all feel like hopefully we're coming out of this post-pandemic world, and we're trying to find normalcy in some way in our lives and in our practices and facilities, right? Hopefully we've learned some lessons on what we have done right and done wrong in the last 3 years. So from your opinion, and of course I have my opinion too, what should we watch for if we ever happen to find ourselves in this position in the future?
Yeah, I'd like to think we'd be able to sort of mobilize and act quickly, relatively speaking. And hopefully this doesn't happen. But should we find ourselves in a similar position? You know, I think a lesson that we should have learned and should be learning is that when our attention moves and focuses in one area and it grabs all our attention, we can lose sight of other related things that are really important. What I mean by that is, you know, as a result of the focus on COVID, right, and the isolation that a lot of people faced, some historical issues that we have had societally, like substance dependence, right? Dependency on alcohol and drugs, other sort of mental health issues have really exploded, right? And I think that the data is available, but had been sort of masked a little bit by the primary focus, which had been COVID for so long. And now that the sort of dust clears a little bit, there is a tremendous opportunity to try to help those populations that are struggling. And I don't know that we're well equipped to do it, right? I don't know that we're as equipped as we need to be. So the lesson learned would be don't take your eye off of the other things that matter just because there's something, you know, over here that creates a lot of need for attention. Easier said than done, of course, but that's one thing that struck me. And just looking at the information we see and dealing with this, everyone has a personal story too, dealing with long COVID or a behavioral or mental issue, health-wise related to, some form of what COVID did physically or emotionally. And so I think to me, that's an important lesson to be learned for next time. If there is
one. I completely agree. I second that 100% because I think we all have felt that. If we haven't had mental health in our lives before, we definitely have in some ways felt it either personally or we know someone who has. And so we can't ignore it. We have to mobilize and have like a team effort, so to speak. We have to have these things in place so that we know exactly what to do. And so no one gets left behind, no matter what we're dealing with, right? So, well, thank you so much, Joey, for being on the show. I have had such a great time chatting with you and learning from you. I know our listeners are probably just going to replay this episode over and over again. And we wish good things for you. And we'll go ahead and put your information in our show notes. But just for our listeners, where can we find you, either online or where you're going to be at conferences? And where can we find you?
Oh, well, it's been a pleasure meeting and speaking with you, too. Very much appreciate the opportunity, Jennifer. So I spend time on LinkedIn. That's probably my social media place of preference, and try to keep up on the goings on and share where I can what's going on in our world. And then we focus primarily in the pharmacy space, so we tend to attend the industry's focused conferences in either the insurance benefits space or the provider focused space. But other than that, most of our team here in Nashville is heads down, trying to crank away at the problems we talked a lot about today. So really good questions. Really appreciate them.
Well, thank you so much to your team and all that they do. And we wish you the best, and we'll keep an eye on you, and hopefully we'll connect in the future. Thank you, everyone, for listening today. We want to thank our amazing sponsors over at OncoSpark and our podcast producer, Gabriel Fass, with Highland Productions. Until next time.
Thanks for joining us this week on Healthcare Crossroads. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, so you'll never miss a show. Thank you to our sponsors at OncoSpark. OncoSpark is a technology-enabled revenue cycle management company. They help you effectively manage claims data with technology solutions. Check out their website to learn more at www.oncospark.com. Thank you, OncoSpark.